Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Stephen Rosenfeld, who assesses the rationale behind election recounts in key Midwestern battleground states and the question of legitimacy looming over the 2016 presidential election results. Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas, who examines corporate media's coverage of the 2016 election campaign and concerns about the normalization of hate and lies after President-elect Trump takes office in January, and retired union coal miner Ron Paulley, who talks about the campaign to win congressional passage of the Coal Miners Protection Act that would extend promised health care benefits to retired miners. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For weeks, hundreds of thousands of South Koreans have flooded into the streets of Seoul to demand the resignation of President Park Geun-hye in the largest protests in a generation. In late October, a corruption scandal exploded, which engulfed Park and her key associates. Allegations surfaced suggesting government officials pressured major corporations like Samsung to make multi-million dollar donations to sports groups controlled by Choi Soon-sil, a longtime friend of the president. The scandal forced Park, daughter of former South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee, to apologize and fire top aides who now face criminal charges. President Park is immune from prosecution as long as she remains in office. Park first met the Choi family in the 1970s after her mother was assassinated by a bullet meant for her father. After Choi's father, who ran a Christian sect, claimed that he could contact her dead mother, the two families remained close. A 2007 U.S. State Department cable leaked by WikiLeaks from the embassy staff in Seoul claimed the elder Choi had complete control over Park Geun-hye's body and soul during her formative years, and that his children accumulated enormous wealth as a result. The opposition is now gearing up for an impeachment drive against Park, who has 14 months left in office. 2 years ago, armed police in Sandpoint, Idaho, killed Native American Janetta Riley. Riley, who was homeless and pregnant with a history of mental illness, refused to drop a knife before she was shot by police. Only moments earlier, her husband had sought aid at a local hospital, fearing Riley would commit suicide. According to the news magazine In These Times, Riley, a descendant of the Suquamish tribe, joins a long list of Native Americans killed in confrontations with police. Between May 2014 and November 2015, 29 Native Americans were killed by police across the United States, yet only one incident gained sustained media coverage. That case involved a Rosebud Sioux man named Paul Castaway, who was killed by police in Denver as he attempted to commit suicide. In Minneapolis, local reporters largely ignored the police killing of a White Earth Ojibwe man, Philip Quinn, while in contrast, local media provided extensive coverage to a slain black man, Jamar Clark. Both men were killed in the fall of 2015, 1 year after the police killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. The media has also largely ignored decades of discrimination against Native peoples in New Mexico and South Dakota. Many of America's poorest workers toil in America's massive food chain, which includes farm workers, laborers in food processing plants, supermarket workers, and restaurant staff. Despite recent job growth within the food industry, which now employs more people than work in the U.S. manufacturing sector, wages remain stagnant with few benefits. The average wage for workers in the food sector is just $10 an hour, with incomes of only $16,000 per year. According to a new study, No Piece of the Pie, by the Food Chain Workers Alliance and Solidarity Research Collaborative, over 21 million people work in the food chain. Not only does the average job pay poorly, but these workers are more likely to rely on food stamps and other public assistance than in any other industry in the American economy. These harsh conditions persist even with the emergence of new movements pushing to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. The average employee in the food industry earns over $7 an hour less than other U.S. workers. Even when compared with the construction sector, which attracts many immigrant workers, wages are much lower in agriculture and restaurants. Moreover, union representation rates among workers in food processing, distribution, and retail has fallen sharply over the last 20 years. Today, food system CEOs enjoy an annual median wage of $120,000 a year, making about six times that of a frontline worker. For every dollar earned by a food CEO, an average worker brings home only 17 cents. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein has captured national attention in this anxious post-election period by calling for recounts in the battleground states of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Despite Stein's own view that the recounts won't likely change the election outcome, the two-time Green Party standard bearer says she's launched the recount drive to draw attention to serious questions that have emerged about the integrity of the nation's voting system after allegations that Russia had hacked Democratic Party emails and concern about the security of older electronic voting machines. While Donald Trump won the election based on the archaic Electoral College vote allocation, he lost the popular vote by more than 2 million ballots. Although Hillary Clinton had not requested a recount, her campaign decided to take part in the effort, as they said, to ensure that it's fair to all sides. Thus far, the Green Party has raised more than $6 million that will help pay for the recounts in the three states. The Wisconsin Elections Commission agreed to begin a recount of the presidential election on December 1st, but was sued by Stein after the agency declined to require county officials to recount the votes by hand. Stein has also filed a lawsuit in Pennsylvania to force a recount there and plans to formally request a recount in Michigan on November 30th. If a state begins the process of an official recount and doesn't complete it by the federal deadline of December 13th, they run the risk of not having their electoral votes count. Your reporter spoke with Stephen Rosenfeld, who covers national political issues for Alternet. Here he assesses the rationale behind the election recounts and the question of legitimacy looming over the 2016 presidential election results.
The Greens are really committed to this notion of verifying the vote, and that they believe that by casting the spotlight on the different voting systems and the procedures, and they're not the same, and it gets sort of stuck in the different silos and in the weeds a little bit, in these three different states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, that they're really going to show people how rickety the voting system is, how unreliable the counting is, how imprecise it is, how hard it is to actually walk away with confidence. And now some states will be better than others, and this is the way it is across the country. Some states are better than others. So they're doing it for that reason, and, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen. It may very well be that they will, it's only 11,000 votes in Michigan, that they might change a result there. But, you know, this is like changing or winning three Floridas. You have to win all three to reverse the presidential election. So that's what's so very unlikely.
Steve, in doing these vote recounts, what is going to be the focus? Is it looking for electronic voting machine flaws in the vote count, accidental or deliberate? And or is it hacking of the vote by political operatives inside the U.S. or has been suggested by some the vote being skewed by outside operatives like the nation of Russia?
The purpose of a recount is to verify the vote. Now, you have different ways that people vote in different states. And it's not just voting by mail or voting in polling places. There's different kinds of machinery in polling places. In some places, you take a pen and you mark a paper ballot, and the paper ballot gets scanned. In Michigan, for example, there was something like 80 to 90,000 ballots that were scanned that didn't register a presidential vote. There were only 11,000 votes separating Clinton and Trump. You know, the Michigan state election officials are very defensive about that. They say nothing is wrong. But, you know, this becomes an example of many examples of, well, let's take a look. Why does it hurt? You know, verify. Don't take anybody's word. Then in other states, you have other aspects of the voting systems that raise different questions. So in Wisconsin, for example, people noticed that in the counties that primarily used the paperless machines, Donald Trump's margin of victory was between 10 and 15%, the largest in the states. And in the counties that relied mostly on paper ballots, Hillary Clinton won. They also see in some of these counties where there was supposedly this great rural upsurgence of non-college graduate white voters, that the turnout was 85, 90%. You know, they want to go into these towns where there are several hundred people, and if they can find a dozen or two dozen people who said, I'm not going to vote, I don't care, those guys do nothing for me, then all of a sudden it looks like the turnout numbers are not right, and you move to the next set of questions, which is, well, what happened? Did an electronic machine not run right? Did somebody tinker with the results? And that's when you get the whole arc of conspiracy theories. What you have here is a series of dots that is going to be very hard to connect.
You've written a book about counting the votes. From your perspective, what do we have to do to clean up the mess of both the machinery of elections in the United States, as well as the hodgepodge of different laws state by state, many of which, since the demise of the Voting Rights Act, courtesy of the Supreme Court, we've seen a lot of voter suppression laws go into place in Republican-controlled states. What's the essential job here from this date forward, where we have to repair our electoral system?
Well, the essential job is to simplify the process of making voter registration easier and almost universal. And some states are actually doing that. The barriers to entry, whether it's registration or getting a ballot on a polling place, they should just be lowered. And in many places, they're not lowered. And that's what all the voter registration, voter suppression, you know, all that sort of partisan tinkering with the rules comes from. And on the vote counting side, as old-fashioned as this sounds, you really need to use paper ballots so that there can be recounts. Anything else leaves you with the guessing game that we're going to be reading about in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin.
That was journalist Steven Rosenfeld, who writes for Alternate.org and is author of the book Count My Vote, A Citizen's Guide to Voting. Find his recent articles on the 2016 election recount by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From the moment Donald Trump launched his presidential candidacy in the Republican Party primary, it was clear that the real estate billionaire and reality TV star was not just another ordinary politician. His denunciations of Mexicans, Muslims, and raw expressions of misogyny disregarded the standard GOP dog whistle style bigotry that's been part of the party for decades. Instead, Trump's incendiary hate speech, linked with the scapegoating of minorities, succeeded in galvanizing his support among white men who were eager to identify those to blame for the decline of America's middle class and their standard of living. Although the right-wing populism with bogus bumper sticker-like policy solutions helped Trump win the GOP nomination in the Electoral College vote, most Americans saw through the scam and voted against him. At the outset of the campaign, major corporate media outlets provided billions of dollars of free airtime to Trump, owing to the public's fascination with his circus sideshow persona and the profits high ratings brought in. But even as the November election drew closer, the nation's major newspapers and TV networks accorded Trump's extremist rhetoric a false equivalency to that of his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. This normalization of Trump's hate-filled views continued after he won the election, when former head of Breitbart News and campaign CEO Steve Bannon was appointed as Trump's chief White House strategist. The Washington Post didn't describe him as the promoter of vicious racism, misogyny, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism, which he was. Instead, the Capitol's paper of record benignly described him as a hard-charging strategist who does not shy away from the rigors of a tough campaign. Your reporter spoke with Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, who examines corporate media's coverage of the 2016 election campaign and concerns about the normalization of hate and lies after President-elect Trump takes office in January.
The worst performances in journalism within the mainstream, the corporate commercial press, call it what you like, are really the television stations. They're the place most people go for news, and they're the place where people get the least news and the least important news and often the most distorted news. So we know how to make a critique of Fox Media. It's ideologically open about its right-wing perspective. But I'm talking here not so much about Fox, but about CNN. You know, there've been several news executives quoted saying some version of this, that Trump is bad for democracy, great for the ratings, and therefore great for the bottom line. And it's one of those times when you see the crass profit motive of corporate media come to the fore most directly. And so that's a critique specifically of television. And I think television is kind of at the heart of the rot in a lot of ways. You know, as Noam Chomsky's been pointing out for a couple of years now, the Republican Party is not any longer a traditional parliamentary party in the sense that it's interesting in governing and in working through the typical legislative and executive functions. It's really a bizarre combination of elements that, you know, include conservative Christians and libertarian Republicans and the standard corporate class and a Tea Party movement that is often overtly racist, disaffected working class people who used to vote Democrat. I mean, it's a weird mix. And I don't think that the mainstream media on any front, whether it's television or newspapers, have done a very good job of explaining the modern Republican Party, of which Trump is an outgrowth.
Robert Jensen, in what ways has the media normalized the racism, xenophobia, and misogyny that was certainly a primary feature of the Trump campaign through both the primary campaign as well as the general election campaign?
Yeah. Well, this is where we see the traditional norm of objectivity begin to fall apart, that, you know, if you're going to quote Democrats saying Trump is racist and then quote Trump and other Republicans saying, no, we're not racist, it's to miss the point that it's not a question of whether Donald Trump is overtly racist in the form of the Klan. He certainly said things that lead to that conclusion at times. But more importantly was his ability to mobilize a very, I was going to say latent, but I don't even think it was fair to call it a latent white nationalist racism, because in polite circles, that kind of racism is unacceptable. It's been in the fore of American politics now for the last 8 years. Ever since Barack Obama was elected, there was a space in mainstream political discourse for an overt racism that we hadn't seen in a long time.
Robert, what are your concerns going forward with the corporate media and the ways in which they may treat the incoming Trump regime in terms of really letting Trump and his associates in the administration off the hook for some views which are really on the fringe of American political discourse? And by that, I mean extremist, racist, xenophobic.
Yeah, I think you're right, because for all the political debates about issues in a free society where we sort of start with the idea that everything's up for debate, there have to be some things that are no longer, in a sense, debatable. And one of them is the inherent humanity and equality of all people. And when you have people on the fringes now moving toward the center who want to, in a sense, relitigate the civil rights movement, well, I think it's fair to say that that's outside the bounds of acceptable discourse. But before we even get to how they're going to deal with those kind of complex questions, let's look at just what's happened since the election. And there are two really important things that I found very disturbing. One was that a number of news media leaders, and this were some of the anchors from both network and cable news, as well as editors and news managers, they agreed to a private, off-the-record meeting with Donald Trump. Now, I don't know under what conception of journalism you would agree to an off-the-record meeting with a president-elect who has spent the entire campaign attacking you and attacking the concept of freedom of expression in some sense, and certainly attacking the concept of rationality, which Donald Trump's life is an attack on rationality. That was the first indication that the news media is not even capable of understanding what they're dealing with. The second was the New York Times meeting with Donald Trump. So as you may know, the New York Times staff, the publisher, the editor, and a number of columnists and reporters sat down for a on-the-record interview with Donald Trump. The transcript of it is on the New York Times website. And it's chilling to read it, not only because Trump is still Trump, but because the New York Times staff, they're so solicitous of this guy. There's the New York Times staff, up to and including the publisher, yucking it up with this guy. They're treating him again like he's a statesman of some sort. You know, that is not the appropriate response of a news organization to a politician in general, but certainly not to one as bizarre as Donald Trump. Again, someone who has both attacked journalists and someone who has routinely said that he doesn't really care about the facts. He doesn't really care about reason. It may sound a bit hyperbolic, but I literally found it a chilling read, and it doesn't bode well.
That was Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of the forthcoming book titled The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. Find links to Jensen's articles and related media analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A New York Times editorial on November 28th scolded Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky for his refusal to support legislation called the Miners Protection Act. In the wake of major shifts in the coal industry and many bankruptcies, coal companies have in many cases been released from their obligation to guarantee cradle-to-grave health care for their union employees. Those benefits were won in 1946. Through negotiations between then-President Harry Truman and the powerful president of the United Mine Workers of America at the time, John L. Lewis. The proposed legislation would shore up United Mine Workers of America pension and health benefits programs that are now headed toward insolvency, because fewer coal companies pay into the programs that at the same time have seen a growth in the numbers of beneficiaries. The program would be funded not through tax dollars, but through some of the interest that's accrued on the more than $3 billion in the government's abandoned mine land fund. On a trip to West Virginia last August, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus met Ron Pauley, who worked almost 34 years in underground and surface mines and in coal prep plants. Tuhus reached him by phone to discuss the status of the bill, how the legislation would benefit miners, and the current campaign to gain congressional passage. He also comments on the dubious promises of President-elect Donald Trump to revive the U.S. coal industry.
One thing on this legislation, the Miners Protection Act, it's so important to me and more important to other people's, is it's our insurance, our prescription drugs. You take some of the retirees that draw a small pension during the year, it might be $700 a month, $800 a month. This will cripple them if they have to go out and buy insurance. They've worked all their life, been promised cradle-to-grave health care since 1946 by the sitting president then. And we've worked for lower wages, lower benefits than other people, because we were on the presumption that we would have health care from cradle to grave. It's not a appropriation of money or any money to the taxpayer. It's coming from abandoned coal mine act, which has $3.something billion, and we just want to use some of the interest money out, and that's coal company money. It's not costing the taxpayer 1 cent, but you're looking upwards of 100,000 coal miners, widows, and dependents that's going to lose their health care.
I know that you and other miners have been to Washington many times to talk to members of Congress about the Miners Protection Act. For some reason, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the majority leader, hasn't come out in support.
Mr. McConnell's comments about it just covering union miners and non-union miners. You look at dollar per hour, they paid their non-union miners more. They never was promised nothing. They had insurance while they worked. Never was promised health care. What the union miners were, and it's been in every contract since then that we have cradle-grade health care. I think that Mr. McConnell, he has union coal mines down in his areas, a lot of retirees in his district, and not only would this help the miner, it would also help the union coal companies get rid of this liability and be more competitive with the non-union companies. But I'm for give this to the union miner, which was promised this, and then after this is done, and even our senator here in West Virginia, Senator Manchin, has said publicly that he would be willing to sit down with Mr. McConnell and others and work on a bill or something to cover the non-union miners.
Senator McConnell has retired union miners in his state. Do you have any idea why he wouldn't support this bill?
My personal opinion on this, and I don't have the written facts to back it up, just my personal opinion is he has one of the biggest non-union mines in his district right there close to him, and it's Alliance Coal, and they're putting the pressure on him. They want the same thing we get.
Ron Pauley, West Virginia went big for Donald Trump on Election Day. What do you think about his promise to bring coal jobs back and pump up the coal industry?
Myself, personally, I'm not that confident that President-elect Trump will be able to bring the coal industry back because of the price of it. These mines opening up be dictated by price. Right now, the price of coal is low, and they're not going to mine coal for $52, $55 and turn around and sell for $41, $44. It's not going to happen.
That was Ron Pauley, a retired union miner, working for congressional passage of the Miners Protection Act. Learn more about the legislation and some of the major challenges facing coal miners by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.